I'm going to be taking our lesson this morning from James chapter 2, which Seth just read for us. But before I begin, I wanted to pass on a word of greetings. I was at a preacher workshop just this last week, and Zeke Flores, who many of you know, at least he said he knew many of you, so I think that probably works in reverse as well. But he wanted to say hi, and he knew that I preached there, so I just wanted to pass that on. Zeke is now in... He's in Columbus, Texas, just to the west off I-10, but he wanted to tell you guys hi. So in James chapter 2, before we begin there, I want to mention, when it comes to the field of psychology, Sigmund Freud is the name that gets associated with psychology. If anybody, especially outside of the field of psychology, thinks of a psychologist or someone in that field, they think of Sigmund Freud. He was born in the mid-1800s, and his work went from the late 1800s to the early 1900s. And he is really known as the man that's associated most with psychoanalytic theory, and especially when you think of a psychologist or therapist sitting on a couch or a chair and the patient laid out on a couch and just telling their thoughts to their therapist. This is something that really began with Sigmund Freud in that type of way. Sigmund Freud was very interested in just plumbing the depths of the mind. And so the mind's a really hard thing to figure out or unravel. And so Sigmund Freud tried to plumb the depths of the mind and had all kinds of theories about the interpretation of dreams and all kinds of theories about what was going on in the mind. And if you know anything about Freud, you know a lot of it just boiled down to it. In his thoughts and his estimation and what he believed was science, but wasn't too much of it. It just boiled down to our mind is just the repressed desires. And this is why we have all of the problems that we do. Ironically, Freud is the psychologist that most people in the popular world associate with psychology. But within the psychology profession, a lot of his ideas, especially by mainstream psychologists, they're considered a little bit bunk. I mean, to whatever extent he had an influence on the field, a lot of his ideas, they're just discredited, not really accounted for much anymore. And really, it's just because the mind is such a difficult thing to get to the bottom of. Even we, when we're thinking, we don't always know what we're thinking exactly. And the psychologist that has really had the most profound effect within psychology and is generally regarded as the most influential, at least throughout the 20th century, was a man by the name of B.F. Skinner. And Skinner, he was a psychologist that was born in the early 1900s. I think he might have even died in the 1990s. So he spanned the whole 20th century. And he really took an approach that was very much in many ways the opposite of Freud's. Whereas Freud wanted to plumb the depths of the mind and tried to boil everything down to what you're thinking, Skinner basically said that I have no idea. Well, he really just saw the brain as kind of like a black box. Who in the world knows what's going in there or coming out of that? But Skinner said, what I can essentially do is if I look at your behaviors, then we can kind of figure out, if we want to change your behaviors, let's take a look at those behaviors and let's just treat those behaviors on an individual basis. And if they're positive behaviors, then we'll reinforce those or we'll encourage those in some type of way so that they happen more often. And if they're negative behaviors, then we'll punish those or discourage or disincentivize those in some type of way so that those behaviors change. Skinner is famous within the field of behavioral psychology, but a lot of his methods, they transcended that. And within the broader field of psychology, his methods, there's limits to those because we recognize that we're both mind and matter. We're both the mind and our body and the actions that we commit. This is something that you see all through the Bible as well, not in the same exact terms, but I mean, you go back to Genesis chapter 2, verse 7, when Adam is created, he's created out of the dust of the ground, and God breathes his spirit into Adam. And this is called, Adam's called a living soul. Sometimes we think of soul as something that's equivalent with spirit, but at least within that context, within Genesis chapter 2, a living soul is a living being. It's something that's both body and spirit together. There's both an inner self and an outer self that goes with us. And this is true in psychology as well, and most psychologists recognize you can't really treat one without the other. At best, our behaviors and our actions, they give indications of what's going on in our mind. They give indications of what we might be thinking. But our actions are really the symptoms of our problems. Just kind of in the same way that a cough is not the problem itself. It's the symptom of the problem, the COVID or whatever sickness is going on inside the body. So also our behaviors, they're tied and you can't unravel them from thoughts. But they lead back to the fact that our thoughts are at the center of what's of the problem that's causing what's happening. When we get to James chapter 2, we have a similar dynamic going on. Just as the mind and the behaviors that play out in our lives are separate, but they're tied together, so also in the same way, faith and works, even though they're separate, we could define those in separate types of ways, they're tied together in a way that we just can't tear these things apart without killing both of them. This is, in fact, the point that James makes at the end of James chapter 2. For as the body apart from the spirit is dead, so also faith apart from works is dead. Faith removed from works is dead. But also on the other hand, works, if it's divorced from faith, it's just in vain. There's no point in that. And so throughout this passage in James chapter 2, verses 14 through 26, James wants us to recognize what faith really is. He wants us to recognize that faith, at least as Christians practice it, it better be a living faith. Faith, it might be something that starts on the inside, but it needs to be something that works itself out from the inside out to the outside in what we do. And faith that transforms us from the inside out, or faith that does not transform us from the inside out, is ultimately dead. But our faith needs to be alive. It needs to be a living faith. And so this morning, we're going to talk about how James plays this living faith out through these 12 verses here. And I'll give you the 3 points just ahead of time, and we'll travel through this. Living faith, it does what a dead man cannot do. Living faith does what the demons do not do. And living faith does what our forefathers and foremothers did do. First of all, living faith does what a dead man cannot do. Let's reread these chapter 2, verses 14 through 17. Living faith does what a dead man cannot do. What good is it, my brothers, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can that faith save him? If a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warm and filled, without giving them the things needed for the body, what good is that? So also, faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. So in this passage in James, James gives us 3 examples of what faith working looks like. Well, he gives us 1 positive example at the end about you have Abraham and Rahab, you have our forefathers and foremothers. He gives us a positive example at the very end, but he gives us 2 negative examples to start it off with. Working backwards, he's going to talk about demons and how what they have is not what Christian faith should be. But right here, he doesn't give us an example of a dead man per se, but he gives us an example that might as well be the faith of a dead man because it's completely dead faith. Within the church that James is addressing, we hit this a little bit last month when we talked about partiality, but within the church that James is addressing, which very possibly is the church in Jerusalem, they have a problem with this gap between the wealthy individuals within the church and the poor individuals in the church. And they have a problem, and you see it all throughout. There's this, it's not that the gap is the problem, but it's the fact that those on the wealthy end of it are not helping and are even crushing underfeet the people that are on the poor end of the spectrum within the church. We saw this in chapter 2 and earlier in chapter 2 with partiality, how they're favoring the rich individual that comes into their church. This is seen later, even more clearly in chapter 5, where there's rich individuals seemingly within the church who are cheating their workers out of their wages. And so here in chapter 2, verses 14 through 17, when he gives us the example of someone who is somewhat well off, who is denying to help another brother or sister who is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, James isn't giving a hypothetical example. He's not saying if this situation ever arises. It seems pretty clear. He's bringing up things that have been happening within the church and the congregation that he's addressing. And the reason that he's addressing it is that if that's all that their faith amounts to, that if someone comes to them, if a brother or sister in need comes to some of these individuals and all that they can tell them is, well, God be with you. My thoughts and prayers are with you, but I hope you do well. God bless you. And they never help them in any physical, material way. Then the faith that they have is about as dead as the faith of a dead man. Back in college, part of my study back in college was in the field of psychology. And in one of our classes, we had to do an experiment. We had to do an experiment where it was based on, I mentioned briefly Skinner, B.F. Skinner, and how you look at behaviors and you reinforce or you punish behaviors to either increase the frequency or decrease the frequency. And so we were supposed to do this for a project. An experiment. And we could do this experiment on, we could do it on our pet. We could do it as an individual. Each of us had to do it separately. We could have done this on our pet. We could do this on our roommate. We could do this on our girlfriend if we wanted to, without their knowledge. And what we were supposed to do is select a certain behavior. And we were supposed to chart the frequency of that behavior, get a baseline. And then what we're supposed to do from there is to find a way, if it's a positive behavior, to reinforce that or to praise that and see if that frequency of that behavior increased. And if, on the other hand, it was a behavior that we didn't want to see, if it was a negative behavior, we had to punish that in some type of way or disincentivize that so that that behavior decreased. Now, for that experiment, it's really important that we understand what a behavior is. And that seems pretty easy that, okay, it's easy to understand what a behavior is, but it's actually not that as easy as it seems. The way that the professor, he talked about how we have to define a behavior is something that a dead man cannot do. A behavior is something that a dead man cannot do. So in other words, if what you wanted to try to do for your experiment is to get your roommate to be more quiet around the apartment, well, that's not going to work in those terms because dead men can be pretty quiet. And in fact, dead men are very, very quiet. And so that's just not a behavior. You're going to have to think up another way to define what exactly is that you want your roommate to increase or decrease in frequency. If you wanted your pet to quit annoying you and quit licking you and just for once be still, well, that's not a behavior either, because dead men are very, very, very still. It just doesn't pass the dead men test. A behavior is something that a dead man cannot do. Now, it's ingrained into us. And this relates right back to James, that when it comes to works, when it comes to deeds, works are something that a dead man cannot do. And if we've spent our life thinking that our Christian faith is based on a bunch of things that a dead man could just do as easy as we could, then that's not really Christian faith. It's not really actually working in any type of way. Now, let me describe how this happens, how this can happen. All of us in this room, I think we would agree that there are certain things that Christians should not do. There are certain things that Christians should not do. The problem comes that when all we ever talk about are things that Christians should not do, and we never get around to talking about what Christians should be doing, then we have a problem there. Because we know what Christians shouldn't do, but we aren't defining what Christianity actually is. We aren't defining what we actually should be doing as Christians. We would all agree, just for instance, that there are certain words that Christians should not say. There are certain things that Christians should not consume. That there are certain ways that Christians should not worship in. That there are certain ways in which Christians should not dress. Well, fantastic and great. I agree with you on all of those things. I think we would all agree on those types of things. But at the same time, that's nothing more than what a dead man is already doing. Because dead men, they don't cuss, they don't get drunk, they don't worship in improper ways because they don't worship at all. And they don't dress immodestly in any type of way either. If our faith is just defined by all of the things that we don't do and all of the things that we're not, then we've never gotten around to defining our faith in any type of way that's more than what a normal dead person could do just by themselves laying where they are. But Christianity itself, if it's living and it's active, it's not just about moral living, which is extremely important. It's extremely important and necessary that we're not engaging in bad things, that we are refraining from evil. But it also means that there's a proactive component where we're helping others, where we're radically helping others, that others, brothers and sisters that need help, where we're going out of our way, even in some cases, giving the shirt off of our back to help others in need, putting ourselves in a position like Jesus Christ did for us to help others that need that, loving our neighbor and going out and doing those types of things and being aware of what it means to love our neighbor as ourselves. Because a living faith, it does what a dead man cannot do. And that's something that plays out in our life, or better be playing out in our life as well, if our faith is living and active. And living faith, it also does what demons do not do. A living faith does what the demons do not do. Read with me back in chapter 2, verses 18 through 20. James says, But someone will say, you have faith and I have works. Show me your faith apart from your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. You believe that God is one, you do well. Even the demons believe and shudder. Do you want to be shown, you foolish person, that faith apart from works is useless? What James is doing here, and what he's been doing throughout this entire section, is he's trying to redefine what faith means for the Christian. He's trying to redefine and re-clarify what faith means for Christians. Because, and part of the reason this is necessary, and this is something that we take for granted a little bit, but the word that gets translated into faith is also the word that gets translated into belief in our Bible. It's the word pistis, and it could be translated. It has a somewhat broad range of meaning. It could be translated as just belief, just mental acknowledgement of something, but it could also be translated as faith or be translated as allegiance to something as well. And what James is essentially trying to say is, we need to narrow down what this actually means and what this looks like for the Christian. We need to redefine this. A similar example of how this would affect us is this goes on when we talk about love. Probably many of us know that the English word love, and in other languages, there's multiple words for different types of love. But in English, it kind of just gets boiled down into one. I talk about the fact that I love my wife, I love my kids, I love my dog, and I also love brownies. Hopefully, though, I'm not loving all of those in the same type of way. And there's a difference in the way that I love those different types of things. And that's why anytime that we talk about marriage within the church, just for example, we will spend time on re-clarifying and redefining what love means in a Christian marriage context, because it means something different than it means in other contexts. Even the love between a friend is different than between a spouse. And so this is what James is doing. He's saying, okay, we're going to redefine, we're going to re-clarify what pistis means, what faith actually means for the Christian. And you see this in particular in two verses this is going on. In chapter 2, verse 14 that we read just on the last point, when he says, what good is it, my brothers, if someone says he has faith but does not have works, can that faith save him? So in particular, at that very end of that verse, he says, can that faith save him? In other words, James, what he's actually doing, he's acknowledging the fact that someone might define faith in this very weak, passive way as something that just means belief divorced from doing anything at all. You might define faith in that type of way. And James actually doesn't say anywhere in here, he doesn't say that's not faith. What he does say is that type of faith, go ahead, define faith that type of way. But if you define it that way, then it's not a saving faith and it's not a living faith. Define faith that way all you want to, but it's a dead faith and it's a useless faith when it comes to actually being a Christian. You see this more in chapter 2, verse 19, where he goes on. He says, you believe that God is one, you do well. Even the demons believe and shudder. And this is where we might not completely see what's going on just because of the way our Bibles will translate this, because depending whatever translation you're using, I looked at a few and it's universally, I think, going to be this way. Everywhere else, before and after chapter 2, verse 19, it translates that word pistis. It translates it as faith, 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 faith. But then it gets to chapter 2, 19 and it translates it as believe. But it's the same exact word that's going on there. He's not talking about, he's not setting up a battle between faith and belief as if they're two separate things. He's using the same type of word. And it may be the reason that it's translated that way is we just don't have a good verb form of faith, but believe is the verb form of that. And what he's saying is that, okay, you believe that God's one, fantastic. But even the demons have that type of pistis, or have that type of faith, or have that type of belief. And maybe that's another reason that it's not translated as faith, is because our minds would be sent for a spin if it ever talked about the demons having faith in any type of way. But it's the same underlying word, because James, what he's trying to do is get us to recognize that even the demons, they have this, it might be a dead faith, but it's this dead faith. It's something that they have. They recognize that God exists, and they recognize they know about God. But it better be different than the living faith that Christians should have. He's redefining, he's helping us understand what exactly it means for Christians to have faith, and how that will be very different from what demons do. But let's give the demons a little bit of credit, at least, because whatever faith they have, whatever belief they have in God, it actually moves them a little bit. The demons, by their belief or dead faith, they're moved to shudder in fear. But the difference is that Christians, by their faith and by their living faith, should be moved to work in faithfulness. Because this is what faith is. Faith is faithfulness. We sometimes, it's kind of funny that we could ever picture faith as something that's different from faithfulness, because we never do that with any other types of words. Sometimes people will see faith as if it's just some type of passive belief, or if it's just some type of mental assent or mental acknowledgement. But faith is completely tied up with faithfulness, and faithfulness means to be, if you just look a dictionary definition of that up, you want to see words like faithfulness means to be loyal, to be faithful is to be obedient, to be faithful is to give allegiance or have allegiance with something. It's a pretty strong definition of what faith is actually is, and that's what you're seeing here in the book of James. And this is how we use other words. If you have beauty, something that has beauty is we call it beautiful. This is just how words function. Someone that has sin, they're a sinful person. Someone that has faith, faith doesn't move people to faithfulness. Faith, if you have faith, you have faithfulness. Faith and faithfulness are interconnected. We don't even have to talk about works. If we really understood what faith and faithfulness is, that's going to entail that there's an action component of that we're doing, that we're acting out our faith. And so all throughout James chapter 2, verses 14 through 26, what he's telling us is that our faith, it must move us to works, and it must move us to faithfulness. And finally, James tells us that living faith, it not only does what a dead man cannot do, and it doesn't just do what demons do not do, but living faith, it does what our forefathers and foremothers did do. And so continue reading with me in chapter 2, verse 21 onward to 26. Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered up his son Isaac on the altar? You see that faith was active along with his works, and faith was completed by his works. And the scripture was fulfilled that says, Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him as righteousness. And he was called a friend of God. You see that a person is justified by works and not by faith alone. And in the same way, was not also Rahab the prostitute justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out by another way? For as the body apart from the spirit is dead, so also faith apart from works is dead. James began, he gives us these three examples, two negative examples that he starts with. He starts with this individual within the congregation that sends the poor person out by another way and says, okay, grace and peace be to you. Just go on your way, but never backs that up with actual actions. He starts with dead faith and he moves on to the belief or the pistis, the dead faith that the demons show. And these are negative examples of what not to emulate. But like I said before, you don't always want to talk about what something is not. It's important to get to what something actually is. And this is what he does with Abraham and Rahab. He says, okay, we've talked about what faith isn't. Let me show you what faith actually is. It's what Abraham and Rahab, the patriarchs and a matriarch, both have done in their lives. Abraham, you know the story from Genesis, that he had been promised a seed, and he had to wait and wait and wait for that. But when he was blessed with Isaac, he was sent to offer Isaac up as a sacrifice. And God didn't let him go through with that. But Abraham, it wasn't just enough that Abraham believed and knew who God was, but he let that follow through in how he acted. He let that follow through. It wasn't just enough that his mind gave mental assent to God, but it worked itself out through his bodily actions. And the same with Rahab. This is the point that he's making with Rahab as well, which is a story from Joshua chapter 2. Rahab was a Canaanite. She was from Jericho. And when the spies are sent to Jericho to see what's going on in the city, she takes them in and she ultimately hides them and she ultimately sends them out by another way. And James is saying that all of those things, when the spies came to Rahab, she actually confessed. She actually confesses to the spies that she knows that the God that they serve is a living God over heaven and earth. But it's not enough that she recognized that she believed in God as the God over heaven and earth. But what her faith actually did, it worked itself in the actions of her body, in the fact that she took the spies and sent them out by another way. And James says that James is essentially saying that if she did anything else other than what she did, it would not have been highlighting what her faith actually was. Her faith was justified by her works. For us as Christians, we recognize that there's the inner life. We all have our inner life, and there's an outer life as well. And the point that James is making is that whatever faith we have, if we see that as some type of inner thing, it better be working itself out into how our bodily actions, what we're doing in our body. This is a point that's made over and over and over throughout the Bible, that it's not just about what we think, it's about what we do. And those two things, they're connected in a way that you just can't pull those apart without hurting both of those types of things. Our actions and our thoughts, our beliefs and our works, all of these types of things, they go hand in hand with each other. And the reason that this is important is because on a day-to-day basis, it can be easy for us. It's easy to say, I believe in this or I believe in that. It's a lot harder to actually engage in that and to actually do it. We can even lie to ourselves sometimes that I'm in a right position here, or my life is A-okay and I'm good in everything that I need to do. But once we actually start taking stock of how we're living that out and what we're actually doing, it's a little bit harder to lie about the actual works that we're doing and the actual things that we're doing. And it's a lesson for us that if we've been saved, then we should be starting to act like saved people. If it's the blood of Christ that saves us, then we should be growing in our conformity to his image and to acting Christ-like in what we do on a day-to-day basis. And it's not that God doesn't have grace for us when we sin, or he doesn't forgive us when we stumble, but it's a lesson for us that we not have a type of faith that just is about what we believe and isn't always focused on what should I be doing with my life and what should I be doing with my time and how should I be helping the people around me in the different ways that I can. What we believe in our mind always should work out in how we act with our bodies. this is one of the big reasons. This isn't the only reason, but this is one of the important things about baptism. And this is why you see baptism stressed over and over and over again, that baptism is this ultimate act of faithfulness. It's not just about the mental assent that God is king, but it's acted out in what I actually do in participating in his death and resurrection through baptism. For Christians, we recognize that it's through baptism that we've entered into his kingdom. It's through our faith, through our confession, and through the grace that God showers upon us. And it's through baptism that we enter into his kingdom. But if we're not children of God, we recognize that we're in a perilous position when Christ returns. And we need his grace, we need his love, and we need to be a part of his family. If there's any need that you have, if you have a need to be a part of his kingdom, or if you have a need to return to it, please make that known as we stand and sing.